Metcalf, Sunday, August 28th, 2011. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your Maccast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the Maccast. Well, I guess you never really know what news a given week is going to bring. Man, we had a big one this week. Steve Jobs announced his resignation from Apple, or stepping down as CEO of Apple. I guess it's not him really leaving the company. We're going to talk about that, of course, in this episode, along with a bunch of other great stuff, more iPhone 5 rumors, iPad 3 stuff, some things happening with Apple TV and rentals and just Apple TV in general. I want to talk about some of my thoughts on that. A little thing on scanning in Mac OS X. One of you ran into a little bit of trouble. And the file system in iOS. Dealing with that, that's a tricky beast, that is for sure. So we're going to get into all of that and a whole lot more in a minute. But before we get started, I want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, FreshBooks. You know, I work for myself. Working for yourself, it can be exciting, it can be fun. When you first start out, you dive in, you're doing lots of great work, but inevitably, you're going to get around to the point where you want to get paid, you want to make some money, and so you probably have to do some invoicing at some point. And yeah, there's invoicing applications out there and you can look at packages and stuff like that, but generally it's a lot of hassle, it's a lot of work, and still at the end of the day you can't do cool things like let your clients pay with a credit card, which a lot of them want to do, at least not without having to set up a bunch of stuff and go through a bunch of rigmarole. So definitely not my favorite part of the job. But what's cool is FreshBooks makes it easy to get up and running with invoicing. You can quickly and easily set up professional looking invoices. Design is another one of those things. You got to do a lot of design work and stuff like that. FreshBooks has you covered there. They make great looking invoices. You can email them to your clients. Your clients can download them as a PDF. They can pay right there online, so you get your money faster. And there's even an iPhone app available, so you could do your invoicing on the go. FreshBooks makes it easy, plus it's free to sign up. You can sign up right now, manage up to 3 clients, do your invoicing, and then if you need more, they have affordable plans starting at just $19.95 a month. So you get all that, and right now as a bonus, if you enter MacCast in the How Did You Hear About Us section when you're signing up for that free account, you might get some cake. Each week they're going to be giving away a free birthday cake to one person who signs up from the MacCast. So that is awesome as well. Free and easy invoicing, possibly some free cake. You should just go sign up right now. Check it out, freshbooks.com, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. As I said in the intro of the show, this week turned out to be a little bit of a shocker. Late on Wednesday, Steve Jobs notified the board of directors and the Apple community that he was stepping down as CEO of Apple, officially stepping down. He said in a letter, "I have always said that if there ever came a day when I could no longer meet my duties and expectations as Apple's CEO, I would be the first to let you know. That day has come." And he went on to recommend that Tim Cook be moved into the CEO position and requested that he would be elected to the board, chairman of the board of directors. That was granted, so Steve Jobs now is chairman of the board and does plan to continue an active role at Apple. Tim Cook has become the official CEO of Apple, and I say official because he has been serving as acting CEO since January when Steve went on indefinite medical leave. And Tim Cook in the past has served as acting CEO several other times when Steve was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer and when he was in for his liver transplant. So definitely has experience running Apple and performing as CEO. Of course, the news agencies and the blogs and stuff like that started a lot of stories about what's going to happen to Apple, what's the future of Apple going to be like, speculating and just looking back on Steve Jobs' career and what he contributed to the company. So there's a lot of questions about how and if or when Apple is actually going to change. I think there's no doubt that it's going to be a different Apple. It has to be after Steve Jobs leaves. But short term, I really think there's going to be very little impact. The executive team at Apple is really strong. It was handpicked by Steve, and they've been in place for a while. They've worked together. The corporate culture at Apple is stronger than most companies, possibly the strongest of any company that I can think of. John Gruber said in his post, you know, Jobs' greatest creation isn't any Apple product. It's actually Apple itself. And I would really agree with that sentiment. Apple has a lot of black box projects going on all the time. They have really long lead cycles in the stuff that they're developing. I'm sure they have planned products several years out. If you remember, OS X on Intel was reportedly in the works for years before Apple actually released it, so they were planning for the day when they were going to move off of PowerPC. Same thing with the iPad. All of the rumors and everything that we've heard said the iPad was in development starting in 2007, long before even the iPhone, and Apple, I think, is going to continue that kind of cycling where they're playing with ideas, they have stuff in the works. And so I think we've got several products, and the product roadmap is out there for a long time. So the executives have something that they can focus on, continue to work on. In a 60 Minutes interview, somebody sent me actually a link to a 60 Minutes interview that I thought was very appropriate and poignant. I don't know when it was actually recorded. It looked like an older interview, but in that, Steve Jobs was asked about how he runs business or his idea about business. And he said, my model for business is the Beatles. They were four guys who kept each other's negative tendencies in check. They balanced each other. And the total was greater than the sum of the parts. And I think that philosophy is something he's ingrained there in Apple. It's funny, when I heard that quote, though, I had to think about looking at the executive team, trying to guess which one was which Beatle. So I assume Tim Cook is John Lennon. And just jokingly, I've been saying Bob Mansfield must be the fifth Beatle, but I don't know. I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on who you think which Beatle is. But I think the point is that Steve Jobs really thinks he's handpicked or put together this team of people, and that team is more important than any one contributor, and I think he would include himself in that. So the question is, has Steve ingrained himself enough into the culture, and is the team talented enough to continue kind of the legacy that's been built? And a lot of people want to point back to the time when Steve Jobs wasn't at Apple, and those were pretty dark times. But I think the difference there is you don't have the group of people, or you didn't have the group of people there. You know, Steve Jobs was forced out then. Here he's stepping down on his own, and he's got a team of people who are really, I think, just as passionate about what Apple is all about. And that is creating really great products that truly innovate and change the world in significant ways. And they focus on that, and I think everything else kind of follows along behind that. And I think the team, if any team could make that continue, I think Apple has that right now. So I think the timing works out. I certainly wish Steve the best. Hopefully his health continues and he's able to continue on the board of directors. It's also been said that he's going to continue on the board of directors of Disney. No doubt he has an incredible legacy, and it's something to be modeled and studied for a really, really long time. So kind of a sad day to see him go, but I think Apple continues on stronger than ever. And I'd love to, you know, if you guys have thoughts on this, if you want to give me some feedback, send me some email. But definitely a significant week in the history of Apple and the Macintosh. So what else has Apple been up to? Well, they pushed out some updates over the past week or so. Apple released 10.7.1 update for Snow Leopard on the App Store. I bet you guys thought, hey, wait, didn't that come out a couple weeks ago? On the App Store. So if you didn't pick it up for some reason through the standard software update mechanism and you launch the Mac App Store, you'll see that you have an update there waiting for you. I'm not really sure why Apple pushed it out on software update first. I thought the whole point of doing the App Store distribution was that all of your upgrades were going to come through kind of that single location. If you did install it already through software update and you launch the Mac App Store, you'll notice it just shows that it's already installed. in there. Otherwise, go ahead and upgrade away. The other thing that was released was an iMac update, the iMac graphics firmware update version 3.0. That's significant because a lot of people were reporting iMac troubles when they upgraded to Lion, specifically with the graphics, the system locking up, maybe when playing video or waking from sleep. So supposedly this will fix that issue. If you were having that issue and you applied this patch and it has resolved it for you, let me know. I hadn't heard any firm confirmation. Or if you continue to have some graphics issues even after applying the update, let us know and we'll try and kind of see if we can't figure out what's going on. But that should resolve the issue for most people. So those updates are out there and you can grab them via software update or through Apple's support website at apple.com/support. Rumors for the iPhone 5 continue to swirl and kind of heat up. We're expecting to hear an announcement or see the press actually getting invites for the special announcement that generally happens in September. Apple puts on their iOS media kind of event. Typically, we'll see new iPods, which I do think will surface, but also many are expecting Apple to announce iOS 5 and the release date for that and the iPhone 5. And some people are holding out for an iPad, but I don't think that's going to happen. More on that in a minute. Reportedly this week, we saw leaked logic board designs for the new iPhone 5, and there were some significant things to note in that. It showed a space for the processor, but it was rectangular shaped, which is more like the A5 processor that's in the iPad 2. Seems logical that Apple's going to upgrade to the A5 from the A4 and move the iPhone forward in terms of performance using the dual core processors. The board also looked similar to the CDMA iPhone 4 board, but with just a SIM slot kind of squeezed in there. So many believe that the new iPhone 5 is going to be a world phone supporting both CDMA and GSM on a single chip. Some recent rumors have alluded that there might be an LTE 4G chip in there, but I really don't put a lot of stock in that. That was all predicated on some equipment that was showing up, some LTE equipment that was showing up in different Apple stores, a couple different Apple stores. I think that might be testing equipment or something for different purposes. I think that the chip designs are just not there yet. Tim Cook had said in a conference call that really the G4 chips had to meet certain specifications before Apple would consider putting them into one of their devices, and I'm not sure we're quite there yet. Some people had thought that maybe because of the delay, Apple had been delaying the release so they could get some new chipsets, maybe from Qualcomm, somebody like that. I guess that could happen, but I think that's an outside thing. I definitely think that we're going to see a world phone, so a single iPhone 5 that's going to be able to be sold across both CDMA and GSM markets worldwide. The leaked photo also had a label on it, N94. That has surfaced as an iPhone 5 designation in several rumors from several different sources, so that tends to lend some credence to the images. Also, there have been rumors that the iPhone 5 will show up on multiple carriers in the States. T-Mobile's being thrown out there. Also, Sprint, although reportedly their employees are being told not to talk about it. I think all the employees are being told not to talk about anything related to the iPhone 5, but they seem to still do that anyway. A lot of these rumors are coming out via the carriers and some of their internal memos and stuff like that. So my advice to any carrier who doesn't want to leak information about the iPhone 5, don't put out internal memos. It's just that's they're going to get out to the press. But anyway, and finally, I guess the last little thing related to this that was kind of an odd rumor late in the week was that there were parts surfacing for a white iPod Touch. Very often, Apple at the September event announces stuff related to iTunes and media and new iPods and things like that. And a white iPod Touch, I'm not so sure there'd be great demand for that, but and maybe that Apple's got its white parts kind of sorted out, and all those issues that had delayed the white iPhone 4, maybe it makes sense to put out also a white iPod Touch. We've had white iPods and black iPods in the past, so could be just another one of those things that shows up at that announcement. The one thing I don't think is going to show up at that announcement is the iPad 3. Many were hoping that we would see the iPad three this fall, but I would just say don't hold your breath. I would have bet on a February-March announcement, though, with a March or April launch of the iPad 3, and that's 2012. And at least one analyst, Kevin Kruhl of the Lindsay Group, thinks that it might be even later. June 2012, he's saying, at the earliest. He's assuming that Apple wants the third edition of the Wonder tablet to have an A6 processor, the next generation of Apple's processor designs. And, you know, why wouldn't they? Because according to the specs on the A6, it's going to be four cores. It's going to use 3D transistors similar to the ones that are in Intel's Ivy Bridge technology. Apple had reportedly signed on a new manufacturer for their processors called Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Limited. And if you know, right now, Samsung does most of the fabrication of the A5 processors, and the relationship between Apple and Samsung, yeah, just a little bit rocky. The next generation chip supposedly uses a 28 nanometer technology that would offer better battery life and better power consumption. And the reason the analyst is thinking there's going to be a delay is he's claiming that it won't be ready actually until June, although we had heard some reports that Taiwan Semiconductor had started trial production on the processor back in August. So it seemed to me like they were kind of on track, they were plowing forward, and if they were already able to make some chips back in August, at least some preliminary chips, you'd think that they'd be moving along and moving toward a production schedule. But I guess, according to reports, designing processors, very complex thing, and I, really not surprising, I guess. I never thought about it too much, but could be too that they're having some troubles actually nailing down that new 28 nanometer technology and getting the sort of processor yields. I guess yield is always the big thing, is can you ramp up the volume? So you might be able to start producing some proof of concept chips or some chips in really low volume and quantities, and then when you start to ramp it up, it gets really difficult, even for the big guys like Intel and AMD and those guys that have been doing it for a really long time. So that might slow up the release cycle and keep the iPad 3 from showing up. Definitely says that the iPad 3 is not going to show up in the fall. I guess you could hold out that it's still going to be just an upgrade to the screen and it'll be more of a iPad 2 HD kind of release, but still, I think that's really speculative, and I don't see any reason that Apple needs to actually do that. If there is some sort of delay due to the processor, I guess it could give Apple some time to get more of a healthy supply chain going, especially of those displays. We know they've been working very hard to sign on display manufacturers, and that new Retina HD iPad display, they're going to want to make sure they have plenty in production and are ready to go. You know, Apple really is not beholden to any specific release cycle, and there isn't really much pressure from their competition. You know, there's not a lot of push for Apple to get that next generation iPad out there because they don't have anybody breathing down their neck. And that's good, I think, for Apple, but it's also good for us as consumers. They can make sure they get the design right, they get the specifications in there they want for their next generation product, and they can release it on their own schedule. I think they're going to want to stick as close to a yearly release schedule as possible. A year, I would give it a year to 18 months, I think, is a good cycle. Like we've seen them do with the iPhone 5, you know, they're moving to more of an 18-month release cycle. I think that's still okay as long as there's not a lot of competition and they're still seeing good sales on the current generation models. So I think they're going to continue along those kind of lines. And the one certainty I can give you in terms of Apple releasing products is that they are not going to release a product until they really feel that it's ready. And they've always historically done that. I don't think they rush products to market. It's just not the kind of game that they play for any reason. So stay tuned, but I think iPad 3 is going to be next year, and it could be not until early summer. And lastly, in the news for this week, I believe 9to5 first noticed that Apple's support pages for iTunes TV rentals went missing. And then D All Things Digital confirmed with an Apple representative that they had, in fact, killed off the feature. They obviously did it really quietly and without a lot of fanfare. People just kind of suddenly noticed you couldn't rent TV shows through the Apple TV anymore. Apple says they did it because TV show rentals weren't that popular. And now that you can re-download your purchases via the iCloud, they felt that people would want to purchase, not rent, their TV shows. I kind of feel like we've heard this song and dance before, right? Didn't we hear this with music? People want to buy their music, not rent it. You know, the Apple TV 2 needed rentals when it first came out because it was a streaming device. There were actually no storage options, so you needed a way to deliver that content. I guess now that you can re-download and restream to the Apple TV 2 from the iCloud, Apple's thinking that they can go back to kind of their old methodology. So now it's going to cost you $1.99 US to buy a standard definition television show and $2.99 HD, or for the HD version. If you remember, 99 cents was the rental price, and I think that was HD or SD, depending on what was delivered from the studios, but you didn't get to keep it. It's kind of funny for me because I actually have an Apple TV, an original one, and an Apple TV 2. The original Apple TV doesn't have, or never had, the rental feature. So that's actually the unit that's hooked up to my main television. So I've still been just buying TV shows. So I've never thought much about the $1.99 versus the 99 cent price. But when this story broke, I saw an interesting piece on the unofficial Apple weblog that pointed out that they really felt that it should be 99 cents to buy an HD television program, you know, the former rental price. And the more and more I thought about it, I tended to kind of agree with them. That would bring the pricing of most seasons kind of in parity with what you would pay for the DVD box set when it comes out, or even the Blu-ray box set in some cases. And the main difference with the box sets right now is you can't get kind of first run content, whereas through the iTunes store, through your Apple TV, you can get that first run, those first run episodes of a TV show, and you can buy in on those seasons. But those seasons are really expensive. Another problem with Apple kind of killing off the rental option is that shifting prices and options just on a whim is kind of frustrating and confusing to your consumers. I was talking to John Martellaro over at the Mac Observer about this, and he mentioned to me, you know, if you were a Dish customer, say a satellite Dish customer, and you suddenly just canceled your service, or a cable customer and you canceled your service, thinking that you'd use your Apple TV and the TV rentals to supplement your TV content, well, now Apple just suddenly doubled the cost of being able to do that just on you overnight and didn't even really tell you about it. They just kind of snuck it in there. So that could be definitely very, very frustrating. After this story broke, we also started to hear rumors of Apple doing a subscription TV service. This was something that keeps popping up over and over again. I'm not sure subscription is in Apple's vocabulary. I think they're really just all about purchases and re-downloading. And if you want to call re-downloading a subscription, I think Apple does in their mind, but I think they don't get that real people think there's really a difference. I think it comes down to people wanting to replace their cable, their expensive cable bill, with something else that they can get delivered digitally. And I think the advantage that Apple has over cable is that you can get it when and where you want it. And so I think Apple is thinking, well, if you want to be able to do that, we're giving you the facilities, it's going to cost you a little bit more. And there's the whole competition thing, too. Apple kind of needs the studios. They need the cable companies to a certain degree. So you're walking a thin line when it comes right down to it. But I think we're not done with this conversation. I want to dive into it a little more toward the end of the show. I have another idea about TV rentals and sort of Apple's disruptive technologies based on some things that I read. But before we get into that, let's take a quick moment. Thank another one of our show sponsors, Smile, makers of Text Expander. You know, Text Expander is an application I literally could not live without yet. You know how you get those applications and then you start to depend on them every day, and it feels almost like they're built into the operating system. And that's what Text Expander has become for me, because I often get asked the same question, or very often need to make the same recommendation over and over again, especially in email when I'm responding to email. So with Text Expander, I can type out that response once as a little snippet, and then assign a shortcut to it. And for my shortcuts, I generally preface them with a little punctuation. I actually use a square bracket and then a word or a phrase that is the thing that I want to expand the snippet for. And so that's my little shortcut in Text Expander. And then all I have to do when I'm typing that email is hit that, and it will write out the full text. It could even include links, also graphics, images. It's just really versatile and very, very handy in a lot of different areas. And they have Dropbox syncing, so I can sync it between multiple Macs. And there is Text Expander Touch for iOS, which is integrated with over 120 different applications on iOS. So they have this great API they've made available to other developers so they can integrate it into their application on iOS and get around some of the limitations of not being able to access the operating system, you know, that sandboxing that iOS does. So great stuff. They make great products. You can try them out for free over at smilesoftware.com. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. I have some follow-up and some recommendations on the issue we talked about last week. I had a listener who had a new application on the Mac that he absolutely loved. I believe it was a Twitter application. And the thing was is that he got it positioned down kind of in the lower corner of his screen where he liked it, at the right size for the window and stuff like that. So it was kind of out of the way, something he could look in on, but while he was working on other applications. The dilemma, though, is once he relaunched the application, it reset everything back to normal. And so he had to reposition it, remove the window back down. And so he was looking for some recommendations on a way to fix that or get around it. And I got a couple of great ones from you. So first one came in from Steve. He wrote to tell me about a great application called Moom from ManyTrix Software. I told you about a couple of their products in the past, Butler and Witch are some great ones. This one is also really cool, not surprisingly at all. What it does is it lets you fully control and adjust the size and placement of your windows across apps, within the application, across your screen. You can use mouse controls or keyboard shortcuts to adjust your window sizes and positions, get them just as you like them. And it does it kind of in a really cool way. Once you've enabled the software, installed it, you hover over the little green stoplight icon in the menu bar. And when you're hovering over it, it'll give you an additional drop-down that allows you to control where the windows are placed on the screen and how they're divided out. So you can kind of put your screen into halves or quarters or what have you. You can click to adjust the half screen size vertically or horizontally. And then if you click or drag, you can actually control to quarter screen sizes. You can also option click to change the half screen orientations to quarter screen orientations. And you can quickly build out kind of this split screen or this quarter screen view of your documents or your applications. They also provide an option that you can turn on that'll give you a little grid, and you can actually click and drag and draw out the area on a grid, and it'll even give you an overlay on your screen so you can see where the space that the window is actually going to take up when you finish resizing it. It's really, really cool. And you can create your own custom layouts. You can save those layouts. You can assign hotkeys to those layouts so you can rebuild them the next time that you're working on your Mac. And that's going to solve the problem that our listener was having, because he can put that window into position. He can put the other windows in position on his screen. So if you want mail to take up, you know, the right half of your screen, and then the lower quarter you want to be your Twitter client, and then the upper quarter you want to be some other application, that's the kind of thing that Moom will let you set up. And then you can save that. You can assign a hotkey to it. The next time you launch those three applications, you just hit your Moom hotkey. It'll put all your windows into place for you, and you're good to go. You're up and running, and you're starting working. It also works with dual monitors, and all of it, it's $5 on the Mac App Store. So check it out. If you want to go over to their website, they have a trial, so you can try before you buy, figure out if it's something that's going to be useful to you. But I was sold right away, and thanks to Steve for pointing that out. I don't know how I missed this little utility, because it's really, really great. If you'd rather go the free and do-it-yourself route, there was a great suggestion for that. Also, George wrote in to tell me that you could actually use AppleScript to do what this guy was wanting to do, and he even sent along a sample. So I will include that in the show notes at maccast.com. But basically what a script does is it finds the frontmost window of the application and then adjusts its coordinates and size and pixels to put it in the right position in the place that you want it. So really that simple, and you can do it with just a few lines of AppleScript code. I think it was like 4 or 5 lines, so not really complicated. Might even be a good example if you're wanting to get into AppleScript just to see how it works. Download the sample that's in the show notes at maccast.com and play around with it. But I tried it out and it worked great. So thanks, George, for sending that along. And thanks, Steve, also for your recommendation. If you have any other recommendations or suggestions, send those along. Send us email, maccast@gmail.com. Now I want to talk about scanning in Lion. Actually, just scanning in any version of the operating system, be Mac, Windows, whatever. And what came up this week is, why the frick does it have to be so hard to do something as basic as scanning? We've been scanning and we've had scanners that we can hook to our computers for years. And the reason this came up for me this week is because Dan pointed out something to me in Lion. In preview, there's some new scanning features that are really cool, and they're actually a part of image capture, which is integrated more tightly with preview. And so you now have the ability to scan multiple pages into a PDF document in a kind of a single scan. So if you have multiple pages, you can kind of have it wait and it'll scan all those in and then put them into a single PDF. You can also do something cool, I noticed, like scan multiple sections of a page into a single PDF. So you can define multiple areas, and then when you do your scan, it'll scan each area in succession off a single document and kind of put them on separate pages in a PDF. And that's all really cool stuff, but it requires a Twain-supported scanner. And that isn't all that unusual. Twain is actually a standard software protocol and application programming interface that controls the communication between the software applications and hardware like a scanner or a digital camera. It's actually not an official acronym. I found this out by doing some Wikipedia searching. Twain doesn't stand for anything. It's just Twain, although some people say it's technology without an interesting name. I thought that was rather clever. But the point is it's a standard, it's a basic standard for communicating with these devices. Now, apparently scanner manufacturers don't like standards or something. I don't know how this works, or either that or they just don't want us to be able to use our devices once they decide to stop supporting them with new drivers and stuff like that. But I thought the whole idea behind Twain, and maybe I'm getting this wrong, correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought the whole point was it was kind of a basic driver, a basic standard for scanners. So, you know, I guess they just think, how else were they going to get us to buy a new scanner if they don't sort of make it invalid or not work when we get a new version of the operating system or something like that? And then I thought back to a MacCast that I did a long time ago where I talked about a cool project called the Sane Project, and a guy who had developed Twain drivers or installers, I guess, for the Sane project called Twain Sane. And the Sane project, what it is it's drivers or Twain drivers for all these old kind of scanners. And they have a bunch of them available for multiple platforms, Windows, Linux, Mac OS X. And you can download these things, you can install them. And they worked great in Snow Leopard. Lion, it looks like there's a little bit of issues. There's a few issues, but if you did your Lion upgrade and you had already installed the Twain Sane drivers, then they will kind of work. If you need to reinstall them, though, it gets a little bit tricky because the installers from the Twain Sane project don't support Lion. Luckily, I did some Googling around and found a guy who has actually put together Sane drivers for OS X Lion. So I'll have a link to that in the show notes. The install process, just so you know, is pretty manual. So make sure you read the README file that comes with that package if you download it. You're going to have to specifically copy some things into some specific locations within the operating system and be very careful because you don't want to overwrite anything critical. So follow the directions implicitly and make sure that you're not just overwriting entire folders because you could blow away some stuff. It's in some critical system file locations. So that's my warning to you there, but at least you can get them. The other way to do it is you could go to the TwainSane project, and they do have the source available. So you could recompile, if you have Apple's developer tools, recompile from source in Lion and get the installer up and running again. But the great thing about the TwainSane project was that it was binary installers for Mac OS X. You can go back to the Sane project and get, they're called the backend files, directly and work with those. So there's a couple different options, but it gets pretty technical. It'd be nice if there was just a simple, easy way installer, and that's kind of what the TwainSane project was, although there were multiple things that you had to install, including some low-level USB drivers. But, you know, even doing all this, even going through the TwainSane stuff and getting Sane for OS X Lion, I still had some troubles getting it to work reliably for me. I have an old CanoScan 670U. It's an LIDE or LID 20 scanner. If anybody knows what that means, you can tell me that. But anyway, it's this old flatbed scanner that I've been kind of limping along through the different operating systems with the help of this project. And I was able to, once I went through the install online, do some scans, although every once in a while the scan was kind of scrambled. Now, some of the support sites related to this said that it had to do with scanning to PDF or JPEG, that if you just scanned to a TIFF, it would work. They also gave some command line ways to initiate the scan. And I tried that, and those scans seemed to work pretty well. But what I ran across was there's another piece of software called Snack, which is just a basic graphic user interface for doing scanning that did seem to help, although I need to do some more testing. I played around. I did a couple sample scans using Snack, and again, I'll have a link to this in the show notes at maccast.com, and that did seem to work. It scanned right to a TIFF using the TwainSane drivers, and I was able to actually get some scanning on this really old scanner. So that's great, and you can get it up and working. The nice thing about using this method is it does support Apple's image capture and preview features if you can get the scans going reliably. But it, you know, preview did recognize my scanner once I went through all this rigmarole and I was able to play around with this a little bit. Now, if you don't mind not having that and you don't want to mess with all of this complexity and you just want to use an old scanner that you might have lying around, and you don't mind spending a little bit of money, I have to tell you, your best value and the best thing that you can do is get ViewScan. And if you don't know what ViewScan is, go check it out. I'll have a link in the show notes at maccast.com. But it's scanning software for your Mac that supports 1,100 scanners in OS X. They also have a Windows version and a Linux version, so if you play in those environments, you can get it for that too. It's $40 for the basic edition. I have to tell you, it's not the prettiest UI in the world, but it's very functional and it works, and you can use your old scanners. Again, the only disadvantage I think behind it is that it doesn't add Twain support outside the application. So you're not going to be able to do any of the built-in OS X stuff, but at least you'll be able to have your scanner and have it continue to work. And I just think, you know, if these guys can do it, if TwainSane can do it, if ViewScan can do it, why can't the scanner manufacturer just put out a basic driver that works for all of its scanners and continues to work as we move forward? Unless I'm missing something here, it just seems like greed to me. But if I'm wrong, let me know. If you work in the scanner industry and you know why this is so difficult or why it's hard to continue to support just basic level drivers, fill me in. All right. But there's some ideas for you for getting your old scanner up and running. Now, Dan was a prolific guy this week because not only did he tell me about the scanning trick in OS X Lion if you have a supported scanner, okay, we won't get back on that, but he also pointed out a really cool feature, and I think I knew this was coming. I didn't think about how you actually executed it or used it, and he pointed out that in OS X Lion's Finder, we now can actually move files in folders using the copy and paste commands. And this is something that I've wanted for so long. You've always been able to do a move command in the terminal, in the command line in Mac OS X, but it's been kind of hidden from the Finder. And I think that the idea was because within a volume, you do have what in essence amounts to a move, right? You can open two windows and you can drag files between them. And if they're on the same volume, they're going to move from one location to the other. But you could never do that using keyboard shortcuts. So if you wanted to do a command copy and a command paste into a different window with a file or a folder, it would actually just make a copy of that. And then if you actually, what you had really intended to do was move it from one place to another within the operating system, you'd have to go back and delete the originals. And in Windows, they have the concept of cut. You can actually cut files or folders from one location and paste them in another. Well, now in Mac OS X Lion, it gets even better because, as Dan pointed out, you don't have to choose one or the other when you start your operation. So you do a copy, and then when you get to your destination, you can choose to paste the items in there, in which case it's going to make a copy of it. Or if you now hold down the Option key when you do your paste, the paste command actually changes from paste item to move item here. And you can see that from the drop-down menu under Edit or through the contextual menu. If you're just a keyboard shortcut person, though, Command Option V is going to move the item that you've copied to the clipboard. So this is really cool. It's just a feature that I've really wanted. And what's great is it works across volumes. So in the past, you had no option if you wanted to move items across volumes. You had to do a copy when you were even dragging in the Finder from one volume to another. The only way around it was if you knew the command line, the MV command in Unix, you could use that to actually move files between volumes. But now mere mortals can actually do it right inside the Finder, and you can use keyboard shortcuts, you can go between volumes. So it's awesome, and I forgot that feature was in there, and I'm really glad that Dan, you pointed that out to me. One of the things that Apple and AT&T have made a big deal about with respect to the 3G iPads is these postpaid data plans, these affordable data plans that allow you to access the internet and get your data from anytime, anywhere on AT&T's 3G network. And it's been heavily promoted, and it's a really big deal. But I guess there's some sort of caveat, or at least something that Dave ran across that seems to indicate you might not get that postpaid plan depending upon where you buy or how you activate your iPad. Take a listen.
Hi, Adam. This is Dave from Livonia, Michigan, and thanks for a great podcast that you do all the time. I had an interesting thing happen this week. We had a group of teachers that we gave iPads to. We're doing various training on them, and we told them to activate them for the AT&T service. A couple of days later, a teacher brought in a receipt, and what they had done is they had activated the iPad at the AT&T store instead of on the iPad itself. And instead of paying $14.99 a month, they were paying $22 and $23 a month and locked into a plan. I checked with AT&T, and that's their policy. And part of it, they're saying it's a commission sale. And the other thing is that they believe that Apple should make it clearer of how to activate the AT&T service. So if I bring that to the attention of the rest of the community, if they didn't know that, to make sure that you always activate from your own iPad. Again, thanks for a great podcast and all the great work that you do.
Hey, thanks, Dave. That is interesting and I think somewhat disconcerting. So if I don't activate my iPad service myself, I get to pay some sort of service fee or commission to the guy who helps me in the store do exactly the same thing. I guess from the standpoint of a cellular company, that makes sense, but that doesn't make any sense to the rest of us, I don't think. Or does it? Has anybody else run across this and had this happen to them? Or maybe there's some of you out there who had this happen to you and you don't even realize that you've been paying more than you actually should. So I'd be curious to hear some feedback on this one. I didn't see it advertised anywhere. When I went to AT&T's website, they were promoting the postpaid $15 a month for 250 megabytes and $25 a month for 2 gigabyte plans. I didn't see anything in the small type that if I activated at a store, I was going to be paying a little bit more. So if this does turn out to be a reality, Dave, and not just some sort of strange fluke for that one location, I want to thank you in advance for letting the community know about it, because I think it is it's a significant thing to know. For all its ease of use and the great apps and all the stuff that we have on iOS, I think one of the things that Apple is, and I guess this goes back to some of our conversation that we had about OS X Lion and the changes Apple's making there, that it's starting to feel like Apple really wants to reinvent. I think they already invented the file system, but this is where I'm going. Wanted to reinvent the file system, or maybe do away with it, at least in the form that we think about it in traditionally. And also in the case of iOS, they wanted to make sure they had some of the security and the sandboxing and stuff that they wanted to do. And that caused or imposes, I think, some restrictions. And so the file system in iOS has always felt like a work in progress. It kind of feels like it's really broken. And Renee pointed out this week that he was having some struggles with that, specifically with his Mac and trying to use Dropbox to get around some of the file system issues and iOS applications to kind of manage his files and documents and things like that. And he said the problem he was having was that the iOS apps he uses put everything in a single folder within Dropbox. So if you go into the application and you save something to your Dropbox, it doesn't let you pick specific folders. In some cases, he could just pick an existing folder to save into, but you can't really, when you go back to open, navigate down into different subfolders. It's kind of like that is the folder for that application on Dropbox. And he tried some tricks for getting around it, including using another application, one of my favorites, GoodReader, which does let you create subfolders and move documents between folders and things like that through a file system, and you can even navigate into those folders. And then he was able to use the Open With option to send that document back to his original app. So he could save the document in a specific place within GoodReader, open up GoodReader on his iOS device, and then select that document, use the Open With option, send that to the application that he actually wanted to work with it on in iOS. The problem was that when you want to go and save that back, if that application was using this single folder model, you couldn't save it back to the original location. It would go into that default location for that application. So then you'd have to move it back and copy and place it over. It was just a really big hassle. And I think the problem is that applications with respect to Dropbox, if they implement the Dropbox APIs, they control how they leverage Dropbox and whether or not they'll let you navigate through a specific folder structure, what have you. Dropbox can actually have folders, and I have some apps that actually allow me to navigate down through that folder structure and save to specific folders. Generally, the way those apps that I have work is they have a local save and then some way to sync your document back into the cloud, or some sort of FTP style uploader or something that to me feels like FTP. Usually I have a split screen that says, here's your local documents. What do you want to sync into the cloud? For Apple's part, I think they're thinking that syncing is going to be the way that this stuff is just going to work. iCloud documents or documents in the cloud, I think that Apple is what Apple's calling it, take that kind of approach where you're going to put a document someplace and then it will just sync out to all your devices and then those will have copies of that. But still, I think there's not that kind of folder structure. I believe we heard some rumors or something of the new iWork apps maybe getting the kind of folder structure that the iOS has in terms of, you know, kind of how you manage applications within folders. You're going to be able to do that within, I think, some of your applications, and hopefully that's an open API, and maybe that combined with some of the other options is going to solve your problem, Renee. But I don't know. Let's throw it out to the community. If any of you out there have some creative solution for getting around this problem, whether it's using Dropbox or not, let us know about it. Send us some feedback at maccast@gmail.com. But I thought it was an interesting problem, and it really has to do, I think, more with the operating system itself, the sandboxing of applications, and just whether or not or what APIs or API calls the developers taking advantage of with respect to Dropbox, Renee. So good luck with figuring that out. Finally today, I want to revisit this idea or this rumor that Apple is working on some sort of subscription TV service. It started to resurface this week, and it really got me thinking. And then I ran across a really interesting piece at Computer World by Mike Elgin, and I'm going to link to this in the show notes at maccast.com if you want to see the original article. But basically, he was pointing out that Apple focuses on broken content experiences and trying to fix them, or has been doing that for the last couple years. He points out the music industry. They had this expensive album-only CD, so if you wanted to get single tracks, you couldn't do that. It had a bad mobile hardware experience. You know, portable CD players were large and kind of clunky. They had these bad interfaces, and Apple comes along and says, you know what, we're going to change that. We're going to rethink it. Well, here's iTunes and here's an iPod. And that was Apple's solution for that. Then he points out mobile content, cell phones. People had mobile phones. They wanted to get music and video and consume that kind of content on those devices. But the phones were clunky, the interfaces were awkward, data plans were really expensive. You know, we still say they're expensive, but by comparison, you couldn't get the kind of data that we can now at all to make any of this stuff happen. So Apple comes along and they say, here's the iPhone, here's the App Store, this is our elegant solution to this problem. And then there was internet media consumption at home. They noticed, you know, people wanted to watch a video from the internet, from YouTube, from services that were cropping up, the studios and stuff like that. But you were kind of tied down to your desktop. It was awkward. You had a bulky laptop maybe in your living room. If you wanted to read books, you know, forget about that. So Apple comes along and they say, hey, here's the iPad, here's iBooks, AirPlay, Apple TV, all these technologies kind of elegantly solve that problem of how do we consume media when we're sitting on the couch in our living room. And so Elgin was pointing out that he now thinks Apple's going to do exactly the same thing for TV, but use a subscription TV service to do it. And I like this premise. I like the idea that Apple is all about taking these broken consumer experiences and fixing them. But I think he's got the execution wrong. I still, as I was mentioning earlier, I don't think subscription is a word that is in Apple's vocabulary. I just don't think they want to do it. So that kind of got me thinking about how would Apple go about fixing this experience and making it right? And I was just kind of throwing ideas out there because I want to get the community kind of talking about this, and I want you to give me some feedback on it. So let me know if you think I'm crazy or, you know, this is just wild-haired ideas. I have no, there's no rumors backing this up. This has got me thinking about what was going on. And so I had to think about the experience. What's broken for us about the TV experience, or what do we want to get out of TV that is not being delivered now? And I think things are, we want it on demand, when and where we want it. We want it mobile. We want to be able to take it with us. And we want it at a reasonable price. And I think a lot of people want limited or no ads. So I think about my TiVo experience and, you know, can I take TiVo with me, or can I get on-demand access to the programs that I want? And those are the sorts of things. And I think that the last part, the limited or no ads, is probably the trickiest, because you have to monetize this stuff. You know, in order for the content creators to continue to create this stuff, we need it out there. I just am starting to question on whether or not we really need the network. I think Apple's looking at a more direct model for all of this, but I think that's a discussion maybe for another day. So I started to look at, you know, what does Apple have now? Well, they have access to the content to a certain degree. They have the best mobile and living room delivery experiences between the Apple TV, AirPlay, and the iPad. I think they've got that locked down in terms of an experience. Remember, we're talking about consumer experiences here. And then the streaming and the cloud storage capabilities are coming online with their new data center and a lot of the things they're doing with iCloud. So they have those pieces in place. So what do they really need? Well, they need access to more and better content. In order to do that, they're going to have to figure out the revenue thing, right? And along with that goes, they need a more reasonable pricing model. Their purchase model, and I think this is what Elgin is responding to, thinking that Apple's going to do a subscription service, and I think that's where some of this rumor stems from, is that there needs to be a more affordable pricing model. If Apple's going to disrupt cable television or television distribution as it is today, they're going to have to figure this piece out. And if they want to sell content, they're going to have to do it cheaper. A lot of their competitors are solving this problem through subscriptions. So I think that's what people kind of lock onto. So in my mind, how could they actually do it? Well, I do believe this philosophy that people want to buy TV shows. And I'm saying that in a really broad sense. You know, through our cable company, we buy a cable package or a network package, but we really consume, if you think about how you consume the content, you consume shows. You have your favorite shows, and yours might be different than mine, but you buy shows or you want to buy shows. The cable companies aren't really delivering you that, and that's where I think Apple can be disruptive, where they can solve this problem. They have a huge library of content and shows, and if we just have the ability to somehow go in and pick those individual shows and get access to those for a reasonable price, I think that's what we ultimately really want. I find it similar to what they did with the music industry. You know, we had these expensive CDs, these kind of packaged songs, and we only wanted that one or two or three select ones, and we just had no ability to buy that. We didn't want the whole album, we wanted tracks. So season pass kind of gets to what you want, but it's too expensive right now. And, you know, it really, to pay $30, $40 for one season of one show is just too much. It's not going to compete against buying that big cable package. And even though you have, you know, 10 shows that you watch that are on maybe 15 channels, you still have 275 other channels that you don't even deal with. You don't even bother with, but you're paying for them to a certain degree, right? So how do we make this model more affordable? And I thought, well, you know, why not sell show packages? If maybe Apple could sell 5 shows, 10 shows, 20 shows for a set price, and then you or I go in and we pick the specific shows that we want in a given season, but we're paying for a package of shows. And that's really what I want. You know, it's a bundled price, a bundled deal. We still get the content. They can do rev share with the studios and make sure they're getting paid. And so that's one idea that I thought might work. The other idea that I thought, which could be even cooler for us as consumers, is maybe if they could leverage what they were doing with iAds into some sort of advertising supported model. So they could make all of their TV show content free, but if you buy it for free or you consume it for free, you get ads inserted, kind of like Hulu and some of the other services do. So you have these interstitial ads, not as many as you would get in the commercial TV program, but it's kind of subsidized by the advertising. And then they could implement some sort of in-app purchase model. Either I was envisioning it kind of maybe at the start of the program that said, hey, do you want to watch this program without any ads? Well, then for 99 cents, you can watch it and you can take out the ads. And that might be a really interesting way to go in terms of monetizing. The one thing I don't like about that solution is it kind of doesn't give that great consumer experience. So I haven't really thought that one through yet, but it was just an idea that I thought I'd throw out there. And then Apple could work their standard rev share with content producers or studios to actually get the content on board. You know, obviously, I'm just spitballing ideas here. I'm sure that there's a lot Apple could do to improve the digital TV and experience for consumers. What do you think? I mean, what are your ideas? Send me some feedback, and we'll get a little conversation going on this. But I'm still not buying that Apple's going to go with some sort of subscription model. I think they're going to do something completely different. And those were just some of the concepts that I thought of. So that's going to do it for this week. Thanks for listening. Before I leave you, I do want to thank all of my show sponsors. Phoronix, makers of Deep Freeze and PowerSave Mac. They've upgraded. They have Lion compatibility and Deep Freeze, so you can check it out over at Phoronix.com. Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. Great note-taking application. Perfect for back to school. If you have a student or a teacher, someone going back on campus, get them a copy of Notebook. I think they'll really enjoy it. You can find more information and details at circusponies.com. Smile, you know, I love Text Expander. It is a critical application along with the rest of the Smile stuff. PDF Pen Disk Label, you can find information and details on all of it over at smilesoftware.com. And FreshBooks, the online invoicing service that is easy to use and gets you paid faster. Check them out over at FreshBooks.com. And don't forget, when you sign up, mention that MacCast is where you found out about them, and you might get some free cake. So big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. Big thank you to you. I think I gave you a lot of ways or ideas for giving me some feedback this week. I'd love to hear from you. You can send all of that to maccast@gmail.com or call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9, and leave a voicemail there. Or you can leave voicemail for me on Skype. My Skype address is the MacCast. Be sure to check out the MacCast.com website. There you'll find show notes with links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast. And while you're there, check out the MacCast Forum, a great online community of MacCast listeners. They can answer your questions and help you out as well between shows. And it's free to sign up, forum.maccast.com. If you'd like to follow me on Twitter, my Twitter is twitter.com/MacCast, or over on Facebook, facebook.com/TheMacCast. So hopefully I'll see you online between shows, and if not, until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.